There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast bringing together the best bits of today's show from Tuesday, October the 15th.
Lema, Vika, Вероника. Чика-чика-чика, ты смелая клубника. Чика-чика-чика-чика, и без тебя мне ника.
That is the voice of Arthur Pinotskov. He is top of the Russian music charts at the moment. 6 million followers on Instagram. Describes himself not only as a singer, but also an actor, a producer, a scriptwriter, and a showman.
And a model. Isn't that normally what you pop into that list, that lineup?
He's not unhandsome. I'll give him that.
We are talking about the business ties between Russia and the UAE because, of course, President Vladimir Putin in town. Well, coming into Abu Dhabi first this morning. We've been speaking to Roman Gavrilin, who is a board member of the Russian Business Council, asking him what are the most important ties between the UAE and Russia?
There are more and more businesses between Russia and UAE happening right now, more joint ventures happening right now. I mean, as I've said, We used to come here just mainly for leisure and buy real estate. But now, for last approximately 5, 6, 7 years, there is a huge difference that more and more Russian investors come into the region and they would like to open their businesses here. They would like to set up their offices, their production facilities, just in order to cooperate with this big region, which provide them huge opportunities. And exports from Russia is growing. And in any case, we need to search for opportunity to establish location in this region somewhere in order to do communication with the region.
We've also been speaking this morning to an old friend of the Business Breakfast, fellow member of the Russian Business Council here in the Emirates, Igor Egorov. He told us what this visit means for Russians in the UAE.
As we are now heading to Abu Dhabi to join the official delegation and greet Mr. Putin, I'd like to say that for Russians living in the UAE, of course, it's a very historical, very important visit, very important day. The last time Mr. Putin visited the country 12 years ago, and definitely the life and the quantity of Russians living in the UAE has changed, and the number of people have become residents and this country, beautiful country, has increased dramatically since then. A lot of businesses have opened here. A lot of investments took place. And also, we can see the relationship between countries improving year by year.
That was Igor Egorov, friend of the show. Also, Anna from Yekaterinburg, where the Romanovs ended their days. That's where she comes from. She's talking about her experience here of moving to Dubai from Russia.
We moved to Dubai a couple of years ago because my husband got a job offer here. To be honest, first I was a little bit nervous about it because I didn't know much about the country. I didn't speak Arabic language, so I just didn't know how it would go. But then when we moved, we realized that this city gives you so many opportunities. I managed to find a job. I met really nice, lovely people here, made friends. So now I can say I'm enjoying my Dubai life and I feel like Dubai became my second home.
Well, there you go. No doubt echoing the thoughts, Anna, of much of the Russian diaspora here in the UAE. It's half about people and half about business, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Ed Bell is an analyst at Emirates NBD. We've been speaking to him about UAE-Russia relations and what we can expect from an economic perspective from President Putin's visit.
So we have the Russian President Vladimir Putin visiting Saudi Arabia and the UAE for the first time in 12 years. It's part of a big push to increase investment and economic cooperation, particularly with partners like Saudi and the UAE. So he was in Saudi Arabia yesterday and will be visiting the UAE and seeking to firm up deals and some cooperation between the sovereign wealth funds of both Russia and Abu Dhabi. Now, relations between, let's say, the GCC more generally and Saudi and Russia have been increasingly positive in the last couple of years, and that a large part of that has been down to a lot of direct cooperation with respect to oil markets. So Russia remains outside of OPEC, but has been a very critical partner in agreements by the producers bloc to curtail production and try and shore up prices. But I think this mission is really an effort to try and broaden the investment horizon beyond just things related to oil. So we might see some push on increasing tourism ties between both countries, perhaps in aviation. And what might be more interesting to think about in the longer term when we look at the GCC from a broader perspective is there potential for Russian nuclear technology to be used to increase the power sector requirements for the region. So we might see a lot of heads of agreement signed, a lot of positivity around the meeting. We'll see over the next couple of years how much of that does translate into actual projects being developed on both sides, but it does highlight the relatively strong links between the UAE and Russia.
As said, Bell of Emirates MBD. And, you know, half the sort of battle in relationships is deals, putting the deals together to sort of cooperate both sides, imports, exports, sort of finance projects together, that sort of thing. The other thing is hearts and minds. And when the World Cup, the Soccer World Cup, was on in Russia a couple of years ago, was it a couple, last year, was it?
Might have been last year. Only a year ago.
Was it? Okay. The pictures of cities you'd never seen, and you think, well, that's really nice. I wouldn't mind visiting there. One of those was, I think it was Petrograd. And I thought, that looks really nice. I'd like to visit there. And we were talking there about the call of there from Yekaterinburg, Anna. And if you've ever looked at pictures of Yekaterinburg, it's a lovely green city, lots of big buildings on a river. It looks very, very attractive. It's those sort of hearts and minds things that make you want to go and visit and find out more, that you feel comfortable going, that you're used to Russian things or Chinese things or whatever they may be, that encourage you to go and spend your tourist dollars in those places. And I think it's I want to visit now. I want to go to Yekaterinburg. I want to go to Petrograd and others.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
We are looking at the Russian influence on the UAE economy, starting with hospitality, really. Not necessarily hotel stays, but short-term leasing. We're very pleased to be joined in the studio now by Vinayak Mitani from the leasing site BNBME. Thank you very much for coming in, Vinayak. It's lovely to see you.
Thank you for having me.
How important is the Russian visitor to the short-term leasing market?
Oh, they're very critical, especially during the period after Christmas, New Year's. So January, February, March, all the way up until April, they're probably 60% of our entire clientele.
66-0.
Yep, that's right.
And the type of properties that you're letting out are?
Luxury. So we have villas, we have penthouses, two-bedroom, three-bedroom plus.
Why are they taking your villas and penthouses rather than hotel rooms?
I think the general trend for families and high-end customers is not to stay in hotel rooms anymore. If you imagine a family of four or five people, six people coming down, they'd have to take four rooms, five rooms, maybe a couple of suites. Over here, they can take a five-bedroom villa. They have a living room. They have a dining room. They have private chefs who come in and cook what they want. They have the personal pool with privacy. It's just a more luxurious way of vacationing than going into a hotel.
That sounds absolutely marvelous. What kind of money would I be paying for that?
The villas generally go from about $1,000 up to $3,000 to $4,000 a night. And they come with chefs, cleaners, butlers, and the works.
And are you seeing your Russian clientele travel for holidays or for business?
Holidays. Mostly for the holidays, yeah.
Oh, it's an interesting sector that you are in, that short-term leasing sector. It's been making a lot of headlines in the UAE over the last couple of months. What growth are you seeing in your own business?
Well, there's two ways to look at the business. The growth side is from new properties that we're adding on, and the growth over there is phenomenal. We've more than doubled our portfolio this year. And in terms of a clientele growth, it's also very high. There were statistics out recently which said that 14% of all on booking.com's bookings are converting from hotels over to vacation rentals.
That spike in the amount of properties on your books, do low property prices at the moment have anything to do with that?
Oh yeah, 100%. Owners aren't, well, there's two problems owners have. Is one is they cannot rent the property out, and then they come to us and they earn a good yield. And the second is even if they can rent it out, their rental yields are so much lower than they're used to that we're offering them more money.
What kind of yields are you looking at?
Depending on the property, but it can go anywhere from, let's say, 8% up to 15% to 18%.
Well, the reason that we've seen this sector, particularly in the news recently, is because there's been that big back and forth about whether short-term lets would be allowed in downtown. Were your clients concerned about that?
Yeah, my clients were concerned, but we had taken very serious legal advice internationally as well as locally, and we were never in doubt that short-term rentals would ever be stopped. I think the philosophy behind what happened is correct. We do want to improve the environment for residents and for tenants and for investors and for holiday homestayers.
And how do you do that? How do you make sure that the people staying aren't annoying the long-term full-time residents and owners who are in the neighbourhood?
Well, we have properties in certain buildings around Dubai which are very, very exclusive. I mean, I'm talking about one apartment per floor and VVIP staying in those buildings. So we have a very strict company procedure in who we allow in to stay in our properties. We do a check on social media for every guest that's coming in before they stay. We personally greet the guests when they arrive to make sure that everything is legitimate and as per our requirement. We make the guests sign contracts. We don't allow parties. We don't allow certain visitors. So we as a company are already very, very strict in terms of our guests.
And people are sticking to those rules?
100%. They get thrown out otherwise.
Thanks very much for joining us, Vinayak Matani, who is the CEO of B&B ME. Thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We're very pleased to have in the studio Alessia Shiglova, who is the Managing Director of Dacha Real Estate. Alessia, it's lovely to see you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Dacha Real Estate suggests to me an extremely Russian firm, but I was having a look on your website and you have very international client bases. Why Dacha?
Well, we've been in the market for 15 years, and when we first launched in 2004, we really focused on the Russian market. Dacha actually means your home away from home in Russian. So this is what investors were doing. They were buying second homes here as a vacation home or, of course, investments. But then things really changed in 2008 after the financial crisis, and we had to restructure our business to focus on the local market as well. So, of course, Russian clients still remain as a part of our clientele, but we also have a lot of other nationalities.
Do you want to talk us through that evolution that you've seen in the Russian buyer over the 15 years you've been operating?
Yes, of course. So if we talk about 2004 to 2008, we've only had clients from the Russian market and the CIS region. So that was our main focus. Of course, I think Russian buyers were top three in terms of investments in Dubai, which changed a lot over the past years. So for our company, 2004 to 2008 was a focus on the Russian market. When the global crisis happened in 2008, we started focusing on everybody, and there was a lot of Indian and Pakistani investment. Then the Russian market picked up again, but then unfortunately there was another financial correction in 2013-2014 where the Russian market again slowed down. But at the same time, at this point of time, Russians still really love Dubai. They love coming here. It's only 5 hours from Moscow, so it still remains the top destination for tourists from Russia.
What's the Russian property buyer looking for? What characterizes them?
For sure, it's the beachfront. So if we look at different buyers, that's not really the main interest for them. But for Russians, we want to be on the beachfront. So whether it's JBR, Palm Jumeirah, which of course is the most preferred location. And at the same time, there's a lot of Russians who now enjoy golf. So they're looking for golf course communities, but that's a smaller percentage.
Are they just looking Dubai or other Emirates as well?
Of course, there's a lot of rental market here for Russians, whether they're coming here for short-term rentals. If they live here, there's a big Russian community who are in rented, of course. But the wealthy or the people who have been established in Dubai for a long time, they, of course, will buy.
And just in Dubai or in other Emirates as well?
I know Ras Al Khaimah is really popular because of the beachfront, because of the affordability. A lot of the tourists even go there simply for the beach. So yes, Ras Al Khaimah is a great, is a big choice for Russians.
So what percentage of your clientele would be Russian at the moment?
Because we're a very international company, we have many agents from all over. So Russians are not our main focus, but probably around 10%. But we have a big amount of properties that we manage for Russian clients. So a lot of our landlords are Russian, but a lot of buyers are from all over the place.
Talk to me about the profile of the typical Russian client, because we've all got a cliched view of someone who's made hundreds of millions or billions in Russia and is coming over here as a cash buyer for a serious luxury property. And I'm sure there's an element of that, but it must be much more broad-based. What would be, for example, the typical transaction value for a Russian buyer at the moment in Dubai? Is it your 50 million dirham mega mansion on the Palm, or are people buying smaller family properties?
Well, I don't really like to generalize because we are people of different classes. You know, there's people who are not as wealthy and then there's the super rich in Russia. So the same goes with the buyers. If a person has been working and living in Dubai for 10 years, then they buy what they can afford. It can be something like a studio for 300,000 dirhams up to a 2 million property, which is, you know, your average client. But then, of course, people who are coming from overseas for a vacation home here, then they're looking for something more luxury, such a, you know, expensive Palm Jumeirah villa. So it is it's a broad spectrum.
And to follow on from that point, the split between Russians based in Russia buying vacation homes or investment properties here versus people like you and your family, because you're a second generation Russian resident in the UAE who just came here, had a job, set up a business, called it their home and are buying a property to live in. How would that split be at the moment, would you think? Could you estimate?
I cannot estimate the percentage, but of course, in terms of the Dubai economy, it's the investor that brings the most investment here, correct? Because they're buying, especially back in the day, buildings, full floors for investment.
Okay, fine.
But it's difficult to split that up in percentages.
We've been speaking to Alessia Shiglovia, who is the managing director of Dacha Real Estate here in the UAE. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Newsmakers.
The movers and shakers shaping your world. We're looking at the winners of two very high-profile prizes.
Yes. First of all, the Nobel Prize for Economics, awarded out of Sweden, won by Esther Duflo, along with her husband, Abhijit Banerjee, and also Michael Kramer. They won the prize. And the Swedish Academy said they have dramatically improved our ability to fight poverty in practice. Believe it or not, she's only the second woman to win the prize since it began in 1969. Found that hard to believe.
It's astonishing, isn't it?
Yeah, and she's also the youngest as well, at 46
years old. She's the first one who's younger than me, I noticed yesterday.
Really?
Only by about 6 months, but she is.
Soon or later, you'll start noticing that policemen are younger than you as well.
Surely not doctors as well.
Exactly, yeah. I liked the fact that I could understand what they were doing. Most economic research and winners of this, I read the things and my eyes get a bit blurry. But they've been focusing on poor communities in India and Africa, and their research has helped show which investments are worth making and what's made the biggest impact on the lives of the poorest people. For instance, in India, they found there was a high level of absenteeism amongst teachers, which means that people weren't getting very good grades. So they sort of decided that employing them on short-term contracts, which would be extended only if they had good results, led to significantly better test results for students. Another project was looking at the demand for deworming pills for parasitic infections, whether you have them or not, depends on price. So by actually giving away free or reducing the price substantially, you save a lot of lives because parasitic worms don't get into the children. So they've done a lot of work that you can actually understand and get your teeth into here. And Professor Duflo, I think, is making all of the news simply because she's a young woman, and it's a great step forward. And this is her talking about the role of women and hoping that more people will get the prize.
I think both of these will attract more women, to be honest. I think many women do not see themselves as, like, thinking about finance, or but they might be more likely to see themselves as doing things that are directly relevant to have an influence in the world, you know, against poverty or social problems more generally.
Which is a wonderful sentiment, really. I'd always assume that these things were known well in advance. It's a bit like receiving a knighthood. You don't just get a call one day saying, you're going to the palace. You know in advance. They say, would you accept it if you got it, and all of that sort of thing. And but apparently not. This is, the institute from Sweden calls you up around the world, wherever you will, are, and they also want to interview you. And this is the institute calling her for comments for their website.
Oh, hello. My name's Adam Smith. I'm calling from Nobelprize.org, the website of the Nobel Prize in Stockholm.
Okay.
We have a tradition of recording, as you may know, very short interviews with new laureates.
We can do it a little bit later with my husband.
Are you with your husband at the moment?
No, he's still. He went back to sleep.
How very wise of him. It must be very nice to be awarded in each other's company.
Yes. As long as you're woken up at night, it's good that you are both woken up for the same reason.
And indeed with Michael Kremer, because you've worked very closely with him as well.
Yes. No, this is wonderful.
I suppose if you're going to get called in the middle of the night, it'd be nice to have it sort of giving you a Nobel Prize, wouldn't it?
And being given a Nobel Prize from economics and getting a call from a bloke called Adam Smith.
Yeah, it's
ironic as well.
Yeah. You've been looking at the same issue, haven't you? Not issue, the same award and prize.
Exactly. I do feel a little bit like Michael Kremer. You remember the boy band Bros from the 80s, 90s? It was two brothers and then Craig on bass. I do feel that Michael Kremer is a little bit like Craig from Bros, because Abhijit Banerjee and Esther Duflo are getting all the headlines. They weren't always married. Abhijit Banerjee, when he moved to MIT, had another wife, had an Indian wife. But then, during the long, late hours of research, romance blossomed, and they had a child together in 2013 and married 2 years later. But that does not detract from the fact that their work is incredible. This is her, Esther Duflo, in her TED talk a few years ago, explaining what she does. And it's development economics, which I've studied. It can be a bit of a dry subject, arguably one of the most important subjects on the planet. How do you rise the very poorest people in the world out of poverty? And she says their approach is not to develop new ways of alleviating poverty. It's to develop new ways of measuring what works. So when you do aid, like some of the things that Malk mentioned, or giving out nets in Africa to help against mosquitoes, how do you measure whether or not they work? He said it used to be like the medieval times and doctors and leeches.
The thing is, if we don't know whether we are doing any good, we are not any better than the medieval doctors and their leeches. Sometimes the patient gets better, sometimes the patient dies. Is it the leeches? Is it something else? We don't know.
And their contribution, they say, has to be to mimic the research methods that medicine and medical researchers in the 20th century developed and applying them to economics.
It's not the Middle Ages anymore, it's the 21st century. And in the 20th century, randomized controlled trials have revolutionized medicine by allowing us to distinguish between drugs that work and drugs that don't work. And you can do the same randomized controlled trial for social policy.
And the Nobel Prize, as you mentioned, Malcolm, go on to outline some of the advances that have been made in development economics over the past two or three decades. Economic well-being doubled in the poorest countries between 95 and 2018. Child mortality has halved.
Well, Nobel's not the only big prize that has been announced. We woke up this morning we didn't wake up this morning to a Booker Prize winner. We were expecting to. We woke up to this. This is the chair of the Booker Prize judges, Peter Florence.
We have two winners of the 2019 Booker Prize. Margaret Atwood's The Testaments and Bernardine Evaristo's Girl, Woman, Other. There are rules, and the rule says there must be one winner. And I think our understanding was that this year of all years, there is a context that both these books are heard loudly and gloriously around the world.
Yeah, get one winner is what they were told. 5 hours the judges spent deliberating. The prize's literary director had said repeatedly, there has to be one winner. You have to settle on one book. And the judges just kept saying, we can't. And so they have, and I quote, explicitly flouted, unquote, the rules in choosing two for the first time
ever. Is a majority, you know, like not a unanimous verdict, but a majority verdict?
So they couldn't even get there. It was like they all came out and said, we cannot choose between these two books. And so you have two winners for the first time in the prize's history who will be splitting the £50,000 prize. So they both get 25,000.
Should be short straw, long straw, something like that. Or, you know, penalty shootout, something like
rock,
that.
Paper,
write a short
scissors.
Story.
Write a short story, I think.
Both books are notable, as Peter Florence was saying there, that being read at this time in history. They deal with discrimination. Margaret Atwood has written a dystopia, and it's a sequel, by the way, to The Handmaid's Tale. Feminism, repressivism, issues of race and gender. And you could ask whether or not the Booker Prize was trying to send a political message.
I don't think either of them sends a message. I think they ask huge questions How are these people visible in society? How are their stories told? What does resilience look like? What does courage look like in a time of volatility and aggression? And most of all, I think, in a time where lies are everywhere, what do truths look like?
That kind of sounds like a political message to me.
Who would you have given it to?
I haven't read either of the books,
okay,
so I can't say. Margaret Atwood very nicely stood up and sort of said, I'm so pleased that I didn't win it outright because effectively it's embarrassing for someone of my age and stage to accept something like this and hinder a person at an earlier stage in their career.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We're talking succession planning, and that's because the banking icon Abdulaziz Al Ghurair has announced that he's stepping down as chief executive of Mashreq Bank after 30 years at the helm. He's moving upstairs to be chairman, and his successor, crucially, is not named Al Ghurair. His successor is the veteran banker Ahmed Abdallah, who has had a long career with the likes of HSBC and ABN AMRO before joining Mashreq Bank a couple of years ago. Joining us in the studio now for a bit of perspective on this is corporate partner at the law firm Clyde & Co, Niall O'Toole. What do you make of this move by Mashreq?
Well, it's you know, there's an interesting line in their press release where they talk about how they planned this 2 years ago when they hired Mr. Abdullah, but clearly they planned it more than 3 years ago because it would have taken time to recruit a replacement. So, I mean, they've obviously planned this. Obviously, when you have a figure such as Mr. Al Ghurair in place for so long, you have the, I guess, the ability to plan, but they've done it. It's not easy for a figure like Mr. Abdullah to step down after so many years. So congratulations to him for his tenure and for the manner in which he's moved upstairs. Doing it this way, bringing in someone new, but also having continuity. Hats off to Mashreq.
This looks like a textbook case of succession planning. Of course, you will judge this in 5-10 years' time to see how it works out, but at the moment, it does. But 4 years ago, Abdulaziz Al Ghurair said we have a problem in this country. He did a bunch of research with McKinsey, the consultancy, and said the problem is that our business people are afraid of making decisions against the family. He said succession should be discussed and decided early, before a chairman is 60, because after that he won't want to cause a family disturbance. He says sometimes there can be 8 or more offspring, and with our inheritance laws very clear on how the company should be divided, we have a problem. Let's look at the problem that he was addressing then. Do you still see that in your work at Clyde & Co?
Yeah, the first comment I would make is this isn't a problem unique to this country or this region. It's a global issue. You see it in family businesses around the world, particularly where you typically have a strong and historically male figure who leads the family. So it's not unique to here. In terms of what's changed in the UAE and in the region in the last, let's say, 10, 15 years, the level of awareness, the level of education, whether it be corporate governance, institutions like Hawkama, like the Family Business Network, the GCC chapter, the Chambers of Commerce, the stock exchanges, everybody hammering home the message, look at governance, look at succession. The laws here don't particularly facilitate succession, nor do they make it more difficult. I think the issue is internal to families and organisations. They have to grapple with it. They have to see that it's an issue and they have to plan.
We've all worked in companies where somebody's left and you put out a hiring process and somebody new comes in. Replacement planning, it's easy to do that. It's fairly short term. How long a process should succession planning be? Over what sort of period? We're talking years and years.
You know, change is difficult. Let's not underestimate the difficulty of organizations implementing change. I think Mashreq, their timeline has been just about perfect. I know of businesses which have tried to do this 5 years out, only to find that 3 years into the process, the chosen successor is poached by a competitor. So you're right back at the start. What you want is you want that pyramid. You want people coming up and challenging for position. In a family business, you want clarity as to how people succeed. Some families go to quite detailed measures of saying, for example, you cannot have a role in the family unless you've worked in an external organization and have had 2 promotions in 5 years. Only then will we consider you qualified to come back in.
Mahmoud has written in saying succession planning often doesn't work internally because there's so much office politics, and that's why successors are often hired externally, and that's what's happened here at Mashreq. Mr. Abdullah was hired 2 years ago from HSBC. What do you make of that, office politics being a barrier?
A huge barrier. I think office politics is one thing. Imagine family politics. So for all of you out there struggling with office politics, you know, it could be worse. You could be upset, or sorry, afraid to upset your brother, your sister, your cousin, your uncle. And unlike a normal business, family will always be family. You can't resign from your family.
So if you fracture that, it's much harder in the long term.
And that will weigh on your decision-making process for sure.
One of the possible solutions that's been mooted is listing on a stock market if you're at a scale of an Al Ghurair or even a little bit smaller than that. And then you are separating issues of ownership. The family will remain the shareholders, but then you will have a chief executive and various managers running the business. It's been mooted quite often. We haven't seen a huge amount of it, have we, over the years here? The likes of the Al Ghurairs listing on stock markets. It's happened more in Saudi Arabia probably than here.
And I think that's partly just a factor of volume and size. And Richard, you know, I have suggested this to a number of families, talking to one chairman who pleaded with me, please protect my business from my family. And I said, well, unless you sell it or take it public, when you are gone, not if, when, the business will belong to your family and they will do with it as they please. But certainly listing, and I think we will see a return to capital market activity, not this year. It'd be great if it was next year. And businesses like Al Ghurair, significant family businesses which are homegrown, the opportunity to go to the markets is certainly there.
Well, we talk quite a lot about glass ceilings on the show. We're usually referring to the glass ceiling that females knock their heads on when they're trying to be promoted. But in this case, the family can be that glass ceiling, can't it? You join a company, but you know you can only get so far because the family's in the way. How should an organisation communicate its succession planning strategy so that everybody in the company actually feels that they understand the process and they've got a chance of serious progression and they know how far they can go?
Well, Malcolm, I think you hit on the key word, which is communicate. And Richard mentioned this earlier, transparency. You don't see enough of transparency because of family politics or office politics. But if you are a non-family member, sorry to keep harping on about family businesses, but if you are a non-family member who's a senior executive, you want to know, don't you? What are your chances of succession in the business? Or are you forever destined to be number two? So transparency, clarity, planning.
I watched the Aladdin movie over the weekend, the most recent Disney one, and that has a lot of issues about succession planning as well, but we won't go there. Another spurious pop culture reference that I'll throw in just for fun. Someone's written in, for football, Manchester United could learn a thing or two from Mashreq Bank. Thank you very much indeed for that.
What about Gregor Townsend and Scotland Rugby Union?
Oh, we could go on forever. Niall, thanks for joining us. Niall O'Toole
is the
corporate partner at Clyde & Co law firm in Dubai, talking about succession planning. Abdulaziz Al Ghurair stepping down after 30 years as CEO of Mashreq Bank.
Thanks for listening. Melks, Rich and myself will be back tomorrow morning from 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.